From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A looming six-week abortion ban in Florida has advocates scrambling to ensure some kind of care will remain accessible.
And what that means is we pay for people's travel and like the logistics behind.
Also this week, Florida dives into a voucher program that advocates hope will drown-proof more kids.
This bill creates the Swimming Lesson Voucher Program.
We'll also explore the hurdles facing a mom who's battling with opioid addiction, and we'll remember the Florida governor and U.S. senator whose approach to governance seems impossible to even imagine today. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Florida's six-week abortion ban goes into place May 1st. Abortion access advocates are working to ensure people who need care will still be able to get it. And for that, many are turning to abortion funds. Regan McCarthy reports the second oldest abortion fund in the country operates in Florida.
Emergency Medical Assistance is a Palm Beach-based abortion fund, typically called EMMA. It was founded in 1972 by Harriet Glassner, before Roe v. Wade even passed.
Abortion was legal in New York, but prior to the passage of Roe v. Wade. So she was coordinating for people in South Florida to go to New York for care. And then with the passage of Roe v. Wade, you know, that didn't just automatically make clinics pop up. So she worked to help bring Planned Parenthood to Florida.
Today, EMMA is a largely volunteer-run organization, but last year, the group hired its first paid employee, Jessica Haydom.
With the Dobbs decision, the board at that time decided that they needed to expand to meet the moment. So they did their first hire, which is me.
The Dobbs decision Haydom is talking about is the decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that overturned Roe v. Wade, letting individual states create their own rules surrounding abortion. After that, Florida implemented a 15-week ban, and a year later, lawmakers passed a 6-week ban that's now set to go into effect May 1st. Haydom says in recent years, EMMA's focus has been helping people who need abortions pay for that cost in South Florida. But that focus is shifting.
We have expanded to providing practical support services for patients. And what that means is we pay for people's travel and like the logistics behind individuals getting care.
EMMA is one of a handful of abortion funds in Florida. Another is the Tampa Bay Abortion Fund. Board member McKenna Kelly says after the 6-week ban goes into effect, the vast majority of people her organization helps will be people who need to travel out of state to access care.
Our director of case management is kind of become a travel agent at this point.
Kelly says abortion funds can help with everything from hotel rooms to plane tickets to the cost of an appointment at an out-of-state clinic. Already, her group has been working to build relationships with clinics across the country and has been helping to send people out of state for care for about 2 years. She says that puts her organization in a good position to continue helping people access abortions after Florida's new rule goes into effect.
We have partnered with clinics in other states, other abortion funds, other practical support organizations to make sure that we have, you know, really solid partnerships and places to send callers on a regular basis.
But Kelly says even with organizations across the country working together, she worries some people won't be able to get the help they need.
We're not going to be able to help everyone, and that goes for every fund. And that's really unfortunate, and that's what we want people to understand.
Kelly says she has hope that a proposed constitutional amendment that gives voters the chance to enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution will pass. But that won't happen until November. And if it gets approval from at least 60% of voters, it won't go into effect until January. And already, Florida's Republican leadership has pledged to fight against it. House Speaker Paul Renner calls the proposed amendment extreme.
When you dig into this amendment, they would find it to be far, far more extreme than anything else really in the country and even around the world.
As for the six-week ban, Renner says he sees it as a compromise that he believes addresses the feelings of Floridians. The six-week ban provides exceptions in some cases for victims of human trafficking, rape, and incest up until 15 weeks, and it includes exceptions to protect the life of the pregnant person. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Parents with young kids will soon be able to get their children free swimming lessons thanks to a new Florida law. As Adrian Andrews reports, state officials are touting the measure as a plan to save thousands of lives.
What you hear is the sound of kids and adults having fun at a pool, but for many parents, this very sound of splashing and swimmers taking a plunge into the deep end can be very scary.
We were parents that thought we were helicopter parents and we were right there all the time, but just so happens that afternoon, the gate was left open.
Casey McGovern, a Fort Lauderdale mom, lost her 19-month-old daughter 15 years ago to a drowning accident in a backyard pool. She's been pushing for water safety and kid-friendly swimming lessons ever since.
The stigma attached to it for so many years is that it happens to them, doesn't happen to me, or if it happens to that demographic of a parent of, you know, that demographic, and it doesn't, it can happen to anybody at any point.
In Florida, where much of the state is surrounded by water, unintentional drowning remains one of the leading causes of accidental deaths among children. According to the Florida Department of Health, Florida has led the nation in drowning deaths among kids between the ages of 1 and 4 years old. To combat this, Governor Ron DeSantis signed legislation to create the state's first swimming lesson voucher program for kids. It was proposed by Palm Coast Republican Senator Travis Hudson, who said swimming lessons saved his nephew from nearly drowning in a family pool.
My wife, summer dress, jumped in about 10, 15 seconds later. Had he not gone through that program, who knows what would have happened.
The legislation covers lessons for families with kids aged 4 and under who makes less than 200% of the federal poverty level. The voucher program will be managed by the state's Department of Health. The agency will be responsible for establishing a network of swimming lesson providers in every county. That's important for Darrell Paul, who runs Bay County's Beach Safety Division.
Over here, we do a junior lifeguard camp, so we take kids in and we teach them for like a couple days, hey, this is what lifeguards do, this is how we swim, this is how we train, this is a rescue board. You need to be exposed to the water. You need to be exposed to how to swim.
The state is putting up $500,000 to get the new voucher program off the ground. The provision will go into effect July 1st. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Florida voters will get to decide this November whether they want to allow recreational marijuana in their state. The state Supreme Court approved language on Monday for a ballot initiative that would change the state constitution to allow the sale and consumption of cannabis for Floridians over the age of 21. Trulieve, the largest medical cannabis company in the state, was the main financial supporter behind getting the issue on the ballot. Kim Rivers, the company's CEO, spoke with Tristan Wood about the push to legalize recreational pot and how its adoption would affect the medical industry.
Trulieve, the largest medical cannabis company in the state, was the main financial supporter behind getting the issue on the ballot. While several other marijuana companies joined them this quarter in donating to the Smart and Safe Florida Political Committee, Trulieve still gave more than $9 million, most out of any company. Kim Rivers, Trulieve's CEO, says she hopes that money helps combat decades of public misinformation about cannabis.
It's critical at this stage as we turn the page and move from getting on the ballot to now our focus will be on, of course, voter education. Using data and science, some of which I think is going to be new to some folks. So I'm really thrilled that we've got some additional supporters, and we'll be able to broaden that that education campaign to reach as many Floridians as possible.
Recently, the campaign has been signal boosting a new study by Boston College that found adolescent use of cannabis did not go up in states where it was legalized recreationally for adults. But one common concern is that having marijuana legally available to adults could make it easier for minors to access the products. Rebecca Conley, one of the authors of the study, said a review of surveys of 1 million high school adolescents from 2011 to 2021 found adolescent use of cannabis actually decreased during that time.
So moving availability from illegal street sales into more legal sales through cannabis retail establishments. So there's some argument that bringing cannabis into the legal system has decreased accessibility for adolescents.
Overall, Conley believes there are benefits and drawbacks associated with legalizing recreational pot. She says there is some evidence of an increase in cannabis abuse among adolescents that do use, but legalization could also keep minors out of jail.
There is some new research looking into the idea that legalizing recreational cannabis might decrease criminal justice involvement, particularly among youth and young adults. So my colleagues and I are engaging in that work right now. So I think that there are potential benefits and potential risks to this.
But critics of marijuana legalization often aren't just concerned with the effects the change could have on minors, but also on public health as a whole. Deborah Hassan, a Columbia University professor that focuses on drug and alcohol disorders, says people can develop similar use disorders to cannabis as people do to alcohol. She says the frequency of cannabis use disorder has increased as more states legalize it recreationally.
There's a common perception that is promoted by people with a business interest in cannabis, that cannabis is basically a harmless substance. And while there are some people that can use cannabis without harms, just as there are people that can drink alcohol without harms, a significant proportion of the people that use cannabis, and I'm talking about adults here, I'm not talking about adolescents, but about 30% of adult users of cannabis develop a diagnosable cannabis use disorder, and the risk of that use increases as the frequency of use increases.
Another common historical concern from cannabis critics is the concept of reefer madness, or that marijuana users can have psychological breaks that can turn violent. Hassan says those perceptions are overblown and outdated, but that people with family histories of psychological disorders face increased odds of developing one themselves if they use cannabis. To protect the public from those health concerns, Hassan recommends that governments in areas where cannabis becomes legal enact public health measures to properly inform the public about the risks of cannabis.
Putting out information about the fact that there are some risks, that, you know, risks are minimized if people don't use as much or as frequently or in as potent forms, and that people with family histories of different types of psychiatric problems should be especially careful about their use of cannabis.
Floridians will vote to decide whether to legalize recreational cannabis during the general election on November 5th. At least 60% of voters will need to support the proposed amendment to legalize recreational use. I'm Tristan Wood.
And as we said, Florida voters will decide in November whether to allow the adult use of marijuana through that proposal known as Amendment 3. Regulated Industries attorney John Lockwood joined the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast from the News Service of Florida, and they talked about what the state legislature might do to regulate a potential market for recreational marijuana. Here's an excerpt from that.
Let's talk about the legislature, what the legislature could do to implement this.
Yeah, so they'd have an opportunity, and what we saw last year was...
They have 6 months to implement the amendment if it passes in November. So that would be December, January, February, March, April, May. So they would be able to do it in the next legislative session in 2025.
Sure. And I think that, you know, we'll see some of these ideas of, you know, THC caps that came out. You know, I think that's going to be, you know, something... you know, certainly there's probably going to be a restriction on, you know, utilizing cannabis in public spaces. I think that's something that's going to be important.
Yeah,
to the legislature.
Let's talk about that for a second, because the governor has been saying, I wrote a little piece on this the other day because I was kind of like, am I hearing my ears or are they hearing right? You know, because he was saying, the state's going to smell like weed. It's going to, you're going to smell it everywhere you go. And it's going to be like, again, with the California, you know, we're going to go to hell in a handbasket, just like California, right? But I don't see anything in the amendment that would prevent the legislature from banning it being used or consumed in public places. You can't, I mean, for goodness sake, you can't smoke a cigarette on a on a beach in a public park, in a state park. So explain me this.
I don't think there's any restriction on the legislature enacting those type of restrictions, you know. And as it relates to, you know, where the market is now and what it's going to be, I mean, you know, we've got over 600 dispensaries as it sits today and a lot of cultivation facilities as it sits today. We have a very mature market already. So this idea that things are going to change substantially overnight is really, I think, just not the case.
Well, we already have, and the amendment does allow the current medical marijuana treatment centers to start selling, again, 6 months of recreational, and it gives the legislature the authority, or it doesn't prevent them from adding more licenses or creating more licenses for the rec market, right?
That's true. That's the case. But I don't think we need any more licenses. I mean, we've already got, you know, as we were talking, you know, there's 25 right now that are there.
Yeah.
20 of those have at least one dispensary.
Right.
We're in the queue for 20 some odd many more licenses. You know, a potential for a few more Pigford licenses.
Right.
You know, that's a lot of facilities when you think on just the 20 that we have now. There's 600 and some odd, you know, dispensaries throughout the state. So I could see a scenario where, you know, no more licenses get granted.
That was Regulated Industries attorney John Lockwood on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. You can hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. Most people with opioid use disorder are not in treatment, but research shows those with Medicaid are a lot more likely to get care. Florida is one of 10 states choosing not to expand the program. And in part two of her report, WUSF's Stephanie Colombini tells us how recent disruptions in coverage made it harder for some to get treatment.
Getting methadone was hard enough for Stephanie when she moved to Citrus County from Indiana last spring. The nearest clinic was far away, and she needed help with transportation. But at least she didn't have to worry about paying for care.
When I first moved down here, I got my insurance with no problem at all.
We're not using Stephanie's last name because her younger kids don't know she's been taking methadone for nearly a decade. Stephanie's 38 and hasn't found a job since moving. So as a parent with essentially no income, she qualified for Medicaid in Florida despite the state's tight restrictions. It covers the methadone she needs to reduce opioid cravings and withdrawal sickness, and it pays for counseling. So it was devastating when Stephanie showed up to a clinic last summer and learned she'd been dropped.
I didn't even know I didn't have it until I was at the window one day, and they're like, well, you owe a balance of like $400. I'm like, what?
States began redetermining Medicaid eligibility last year for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic began. Millions have lost coverage, including some who still qualify. Stephanie says administrators miscalculated her income. It would have cost a little more than $100 a week to pay for her methadone out of pocket, but she couldn't afford that. Stephanie feared a disruption in care would trigger painful withdrawal.
I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be so sick. How am I going to get up and take care of the kids?
Not having health insurance is one of many barriers that can keep people who struggle with opioid use from getting life-saving treatment. Critics of using medications like methadone and buprenorphine to treat addiction cast it as changing one drug for another. But there's overwhelming evidence these treatments reduce overdose deaths and can curb illegal drug use. Dawn Jackson helps people with low incomes access these meds with the nonprofit Operation PAR.
People shouldn't have to choose between putting food on the table and getting the treatment they need to live healthy lives.
The group serves nearly 4,000 clients at medication treatment centers along Florida's Gulf Coast. It relies on state and federal grants to treat people who can't pay. PAR was able to bring Stephanie's costs down to $30 a week. That was low enough for her to stick with treatment.
Am I all checked in, ready to go?
Even better, the group opened a clinic near Stephanie's home in Citrus last fall, the first in the county. That's made it easier for her to get her methadone doses each week.
Thank you, hon.
Mm-hmm. It took 6 months for Stephanie to get her Medicaid reinstated. She's grateful she never had to go without her medicine.
All the things that some people take for granted, you know, just waking up every day and feeling good enough to do your whole day, you know, it's helped me a lot.
Still, that was a stressful time for her. and for Operation PAR. Officials say the Medicaid population across all their clinics has dropped by about a third since the unwinding began. Had Florida expanded Medicaid, many of those people would likely still qualify. Jackson directs a Citrus clinic. She says for months there was a waiting list for financial aid, and some clients couldn't pay at all. The clinic was struggling to keep them in treatment.
Turning people away over money is the last thing we want to do. But we also know that we can't treat everybody for free.
They cleared the wait list in March when money from Florida's lawsuits against opioid makers and pharmacies came in to alleviate the strain. The state expects to get about $3 billion over the next couple decades, and it's devoting big chunks of initial payments to medication treatment programs. Melanie Brown-Wufter advocates for treatment providers as president of the Florida Behavioral Health Association. She says the settlement money, on top of existing efforts, should provide ample resources to treat people without insurance. She says more focus should be on getting people into care and is skeptical the state needs Medicaid expansion to do that.
We really feel like those who want to access services can receive them.
But Operation PAR official John Essenberg says the current funding system isn't sustainable. He says grants are temporary and often come with strings attached.
The nature of it is that if they can't guarantee grant funding beyond a particular time frame, like beyond a year, it's difficult for agencies to really expand services.
Essenberg says a treatment provider may not open a clinic in a rural area or hire more staff if they're worried grant money may expire. He says that's where more consistent sources of funding, like Medicaid, can help. Still, Essenberg called Medicaid reimbursement rates woefully low. He says the state needs to boost payments to clinics and expand coverage. But he says the investment would be worth it.
It is way more expensive to deal with the inevitable repercussions of untreated opioid use disorder than it is to fund the treatment for it.
Whether it's reducing strain on hospitals or jails, Essenberg says there's lots of ways communities can benefit from helping people with addiction get medical care. But more importantly, he says, it's about saving lives. I'm Stephanie Colombini in Tampa.
Kim Crisberg with Public Health Watch contributed to the stories, and they're part of the Holdouts, a project focused on states that haven't expanded Medicaid. You can hear both parts of this report at WFSU.org. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Bob Graham transcended party. He was the governor of Florida for two terms and its U.S. senator for three. He was a moderate Democrat whose signature issues were education, the environment, and national security. But as Margie Menzel reports, his greatest legacy might be in the hearts of ordinary Floridians. Graham died Wednesday at the age of 87.
Senator Graham, first of all, I called mostly to say thank you for your many years of public service in such a dedicated fashion.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Senator Graham, I truly appreciate your dedication and admire and appreciate all of your hard work for the students of Florida.
Thank you.
That's Graham talking with members of the public back in 2007 on a WFSU call-in show called Florida on the Line.
Hey, Senator Graham, you're one of my biggest heroes. I was born in Jacksonville, and I've always admired you a great deal.
Well, thank you, John. Where do you live now?
I work at the University of Florida. I live in Gainesville.
Okay.
And how are the
Gators doing after Saturday night?
Let's not talk about that.
Okay.
That's too painful.
Graham took questions about public policy and brainstormed with callers about how to make the state better.
He was a Harvard-educated guy, and he was absolutely one of the most brilliant human beings I've ever met in my life. But he also, despite kind of coming from a very, you know, frankly, elite background and all this, he was incredibly relatable.
Steve Shale is a Democratic strategist and Graham's longtime friend.
And it was because of those experiences with people. And he loved to tell those stories. And he loved seeing people that he had met. He remembered them. And it was a core part of who he was.
Graham is well known for his 400-plus work days. He started them as a state senator after speaking to a group of teachers about what he saw as the problems in teaching civics. A woman named Sue Riley told him she was sick of politicians telling teachers what to do and challenged him to try it himself. He did. His work days came to include stints as a deputy sheriff, a busboy, a trucker, a garbage collector, a nursing home attendant, a steel worker, a tomato picker, and a bank teller. Political scientist Susan McManus says her students were most impressed by the fact that Graham worked the whole 8 hours of the workday, not just the photo op.
And he picked jobs that people wouldn't think a politician at his level would do. And yet that's what endeared him so much to everyday people. Again, now we see so many stories about the distance between people in office and their constituents. Gone is the personal touch. And he certainly had that.
The workdays also taught him how people's lives could be bettered by public policy. As a parking attendant, for instance, he learned that lowering the height of a curb could make life much easier for people with disabilities. McManus says Graham used the days as a chance to really get to know his constituents.
And he, by the time he left, if he were working in a restaurant, by the time he left the establishment, he would know every single person's name that worked there, something about them personally, their family, and also a little bit about what they did at the workplace. All of that before he left, or he didn't feel it was a successful workday.
The workdays also contributed to the other thing that average Floridians remember about Graham, his notebooks. His official portrait as governor shows him holding one. He filled thousands, color-coded for each of the four seasons. They contain such pedestrian details as his weight and what he was wearing, but they also contain the seeds of legislation and the people he met. Delatri Hollinger was one of the latter. He's now the co-executive director of the Florida Civil Rights Museum. When he was a student at Tallahassee Community College, Hollinger was elected president of the Student Government Association. The swearing-in happened to be on the day Graham and his daughter Gwen were visiting the campus. So Hollinger asked them to do the honors.
And so they agreed to it, and it was just a beautiful day.
Like so many, Hollinger is trying to imagine Florida without Bob Graham.
And now I have to say, what do we do? What do we do now that the torch has been passed? You know, where do we go from here? And those are questions that are not cliche, but they do need to be answered.
Shale says he doubts the Everglades would be what it is today if not for Graham.
The work he did on Forever Florida, and then leading a constitutional amendment 10 years after he left office to ensure that that dock stamp money went into land preservation. I mean, I remember more than once staffing him in the halls of the Capitol as he came to Tallahassee 2018, 2019, still knocking on doors to talk about that. And so the vast treasure that is still much of Florida, you know, a lot of that really is because of him and his work.
Bob Graham never lost an election. He won 9, 5 of them statewide, averaging 61% of the vote. I'm Margie Menzel.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Derek Hamm and Stephanie Colombini. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.